Welcome to The Bridge, a podcast from the Division of Diversity and Community Engagement at the University of Texas at Austin, where we share stories and best practices from University of Texas instructors who connect on-campus learning and research with real-world community projects. In this episode, we will continue with part two of the conversation between the Center for Community Engagement, UT faculty, and Austin community leaders discussing Black history and preservation in East Austin. If you missed part one, you can find it on the homepage for The Bridge podcast.
We already know that there's this way in which the stories and the histories of historically marginalized communities, in this case, Black community, aren't part of this like formal archive in these many ways. And like what you mentioned, Rachel, the way we archive and all these ways that we hold in history is not always seen, in the same light. And so how do you all kind of approach this with your work? First, this challenge around, many times this stuff hasn't been collected. This history is so unknown by so many. And so important, right? Many people have just recently learned about the 28 plan, the 1928 plan, and how that has impacted so much. So how do you, deal with that kind of coming up against that challenge? And then, my second part to this is, especially right now when there's such an urgency, because we know, the way displacement and gentrification is happening, we are even more at risk of erasing the history that we are aware of. So how do you approach it? What can you kind of jewels or can you give to those of us who are also grappling with this work?
Well, how much time do we have?
I know, right? It's the easy question, isn't it?
What I would say is, I'll just start off by saying, I think there's an opportunity that gentrification does some stuff that's horrible. We talk around it in the city. We soft pedal it in the city. We try to make it palatable. But gentrification does a lot of stuff that's not great, right? Displacement, right? People list those things. I think we don't talk about those things directly. We try to soft pedal there. And I don't think it's serving us. I think it cultivates an either-or environment, an either-or kind of narrative that's a problem. And we don't say these are the things about it that erode our culture and erode our history. And I really feel like if we don't have some direct conversations around how this impacts the financially vulnerable, how it creates disorientation around anchoring who we are and our identity, like all those things. Nobody's ready to talk about embodying inclusion while you're excluded. So I think there's some opportunity to practice some courage around the real conversations and to put emphasis on healing from the way in which we have misrepresented what's happening and then rebuild. But I feel like at this point, there's always a halfway approach to that. We clean out a little bit of the wound, the bacteria in the wound, but not all of it. And I don't think it needs to be a full on clean out, meaning a real, thoughtful, honest conversation before we can really talk about how to co-create something that is accessible. Then, we talk about affordable housing. There's affordable housing, and then there's real affordable housing. Right, I want to talk about the stuff that we like. You can actually live, not this student I'm riding with. So I mean, I think of that all the time, and we have a deep tissue conversation to convene aware of what really what it throws in.
Yes, that's indeed Rachel.
I never pass up an opportunity to preach the good word of preserving what you have. So often, I meet Black and Brown folks in the community here in Austin or elsewhere who don't think of what they have as significant when you think about larger history, right? But we are all living in this moment, contributing to history as it will be eventually. So if you have family photos, family papers, They're in the garage, get them out. They're on the floor, move them up. We all know it floods. In the attic, bring them down. You want things to be, for preservation reasons, at a more stable temperature, away from humidity and very damp places, and places that are vulnerable to pests as well. So think about that. Think about really treasuring. Maybe you got a box from a grandparent where you were cleaning out a house and you threw it in the garage. Bring that inside and really start to think about what you want to do with it. We are in a really wonderful moment here in Austin right now, where there is a vibrant community of Black and Brown memory workers, of archivists, the people who can help, who can talk with you about it. If you have materials that you yourself don't want to keep, people like myself who are happy to walk you through where that might live well in the city for other folks to access and engage with as they do this kind of narrative building and cultural recovery work that we've been talking about. So I just want everybody to walk away always knowing that your history, your legacy is important and worthy of being preserved. And it's important for us to first take ownership of doing that preservation work, because as history has taught us, outside entities might not treat and love our stories the way that we do.
That's so important. And just to kind of encourage people that your voice and, you know, your stories, and that our archives look different, right? You know, the funeral programs and the, you know, the family Bible and, you know, the land geography, like all these things telling stories. So, and I'm having to reshape my mind around that. Like, nobody wants my papers, you know.
No. You're mistaken.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like to remind people that they too are founding fathers, brothers, sisters, what have you, that this country is still being founded. This city is still being founded, that we all possess history. We should think of ourselves as historians and look around, observe it. Like I said, the eyes are like cameras. Treasure what you have. Observe what you have and what's going on around you. And don't think that you are an insignificant person, whether you are rich or poor, greed or not greed. Don't think that you are an insignificant person. And as you said, Pam, you know, we talk to the people who think that history began when they were born. And it's like, I did not know about the master plan. Well, okay, I'll put it about like this. I grew up in a segregated era. I started to see things change, I'm so glad to say. But the very fact that we live over on Greenwood Avenue in East Austin, it was for a reason. Yeah, it was economical, but also because it was racial that we lived over on the east side. There were more Blacks and Mexicans on the east side. And I didn't understand that, except to be told, well, that's just where we live. Well, it wasn't until I read Austin American Statesman, 100-year retrospective in 1971, which had articles around the 1928 master plan. And I had no idea a Negro district was proposed to be created by city council in 1928. And then it started to hit me. Well, that's why we are living in a certain area of the city. And I was 16 years old in 71 when I found that out. And only later did I find out about that there were Black communities in other parts of the city as well, you know, prior to the 1928 master plan. And I didn't know that until I was a grown man. I mean, I knew about Clarksville. I knew about that from the age of 19, but to know about these other communities, it was interesting to note that there was an AME church in South Austin, I'll say Nanny's, And I didn't really understand that. And then my father may have told me something about that, that he had relatives who once lived in that area. So St. Andy still exists, but, you know, there are very few Blacks who now live in that particular area. That was part of a freedmen's community at once. Also brings up the fact that gentrification is not new. It's been going on, gentrification and offskilling, especially where Black people are concerned, is not something that just occurred within the last 20 years.
Yeah, and really,
because the master plan was gentrification.
Because this, you know, is a cycle that's continuing this, you know, this task, this call that we have, that everyone's talked about, to preach, to teach, but also to act. And for me, part of that activity, part of that process is taking the ownership, but also, you know, understanding, you know, that we as historians, whether we're professional historians or everyday historians of our family or communities, we have value. There's importance. And the key word for that, you know, on a professional level, what I mean is significance, because, you know, something has to have a certain amount of significance to be considered historically important, to become a landmark, to become listed to the National Register of Historic Places. And it's being able to preach and teach that history and create that context. And so not only do we know and understand the significance, but that we can, in essence, you know, validate, even though it's important to us and we know the importance, be able to say, hey, this building is important because this story, this individual is important because. And so to retake ownership of the value of our history and the built environment that is part of that history is really important and really crucial moving forward in order to combat things like gentrification, you know, and the preservation of East Austin or whatever community it is in which we're living. And it's not just for the Black community, but for other marginalized communities and neighborhoods in Austin, in Texas, across the country. So it's really important that, you know, whatever these stories that we have, you know, whether in the photographs, the funeral programs, and these things are really important. And they're increasingly important because we might have larger bodies of archives where our histories are hidden or much more difficult to get at. But a lot of the histories that I've been able to gather and piece together come exactly from documents like this, to be able to tie together individuals into families to tell larger stories and histories. And it's amazing how you could take, you know, those very simple documents, pieces of information that might not seem to be important or have value, and to be able to utilize them to create a story, a thread that that is really important or significant as an accuser.
Absolutely. And, you know, just listening to you all and thinking about, and I think, Rachel, you said it so eloquently, this memory work, and, you know, it's so important in so many ways. I mean, a lot of this work that's being done is, you know, helping folks think through this idea around the right to return. Like, they're using these archives and this history for other people. They're using, you know, this information to get historical markers for their homes, you know, so that they will, you know, have a chance in staying and have their taxes lowered and all these things, you know, and they're, you know, their homes are things for the folks that want to, you know, stay. And so there's all these ways in which, you know, the storytelling, this memory work is really, it's activism, right? It's a fight for social justice. It, you know, just me thinking about, like, from a more kind of spiritual perspective, and even one around just feeling loved and held, being in spaces growing up in Austin and being the only little brown face anywhere, like, for example, at Symphony Square. And, but always feeling this connection to the land, you know, where I was sitting, the ground, the earth. And I always wondered about that. And then later, decades later, finding out that this home I'm looking at was, you know, somebody who, of a Black family who, you know, had done all of these amazing things in Austin, and, you know, Red River was a Black area, like all of these places that I would go and been made to feel like I shouldn't be there, but those were our spaces. And, even though there was this way in which I knew that, just think about how even more empowered folks would be, right? If we went with that information. So it's just so much that has been, you know, lost, and some of it intentionally. And, you know, so this work of just bringing all this back together. So, you know, my question around that for you all is, you know, what do you feel people's responsibility are? Like, what advice or what would you tell people, not only the ones that are new into coming into these communities, but people who have been, who are from here, who may not know this information, like how to begin to learn and collect this information and do their own kind of, you know, search and exploration?
I thought, well, that's a big question, Stephanie. What is wrong? You're just asking these huge, that's an hour each. But what I would say is, I think there has to be some personal responsibility and accountability as community members to be, to practice always saying to yourself, like, where am I sitting? What community is? Well, we don't do that. Like, in this household, we're always training our kids to say, where, you know, to think about, like, where are you sitting? And we have had a really interesting dynamic in this city where the people that are there now think there's an ownership component that comes with it, right? So I talk about when I'm over in the Leafville area, right? And I walk into the local, they're like, good morning, welcome. And I'm like, no, welcome to you, actually. Because my, right? Like, welcome to you. Not the other way. And just there's that the Cavalier. We inhabited it now. So it's ours versus this was something before. And there's an accountability as citizens, all of us, to know what that is and then bring that into the space. And there's so many ways that you can do that in a way that strengthens it and doesn't take away from it. So I think part of it is like practicing our way through, like, what was this before? It had to be somewhere before, because there's nowhere all the black people fit into 6 miles. Where else were they? Right? And so I think there's that opportunity. We just don't do it. We don't slow down to do it. If we practice it, it would be a natural part of who we are. We just don't slow down to do it. So we talk about that a lot of areas. Like, before you sit down, what was that before? What was that before?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Pam, I really appreciated something you mentioned earlier about building a culture of curiosity. And I think that has a lot to, that is really relevant in this conversation right now, that it seems like people have to be stimulated to be curious in order to want to know, which, I mean, is an approach. It's not one that I would take, right? You come into a space, like you said, you want to look around and understand before you take up space. But since that seems to be the society that we're in, I feel like it's been, there have been some good examples of it being done well. Through, I think, a lot of public art. Stephanie, I know you've been involved with that, with local parks, thinking about their spaces and historic sites, reevaluating what they're doing to create spaces and moments within those and micro environments for people to pique curiosity and get people questioning and then point to more resources. So I think continuing that work, but I do, just echoing what's been said, I do think it's something that it begins where we are. Each of us has a responsibility, not only for the spaces that we occupy, but as we are in community with each other, kind of collectively, where we are and what we're doing and who's doing it, who's documenting that, where, how will it live on? How will we tell this story? Because like I said, if we don't shape the narrative, if we don't tell our story and protect our story as we wanted to, then when it's out in other hands, we just don't know what will happen. So no one loves us like us. We need to always know.
That's very true. I think everyone just really hit the nail on the head as far as, you know, taking the ownership and being curious about, you know, where we are in a place and time, what's come before. You know, for me, just even thinking about, you know, wanting to know more about indigenous peoples. I mean, because all they know were just, you know, sprang out of the ground. Who were the, right. people that inhabited those spaces and contributed to the built environment, changed and altered those environments for better or worse. And unfortunately for the Black community, for the Mexican community, you know, it's been for worse. But how do you recapture those stories and really reinsert ourselves into the narrative, right? Because history belongs to the victors. And rarely have we been, you know, the victors. But it's, you know, reshifting that narrative and that focus then to think about the history of why these things have happened and to, as I said, just reinsert, you know, ourselves in the narrative and take control of that narrative to then take control of future preservation work, future memory work, as the case may be. It's really important.
Want to add anything, Harrison?
Well, this is where, you know, basically we're all saying, you know, we should become citizen historians and, you know, starting not just with each other, which all of us are, but also our family members, our relatives, those funeral programs, for instance, say those programs that might seem insignificant to a lot of people, but no, that funeral program gives you a history, a biography of a person, what that person did, what that person believed, where that person lived, if nothing else, the dates that that person was born, the dates that person died. You know, this is all history and individual. So, you know, we need to start by documenting, even just, you know, keeping a funeral program. That's part of your history. I have the diploma, thank goodness that was kept by my grandmother, but the diploma that was awarded to my father when he was about 7 years old, or he was a little bit old, no, 1931, about 9 years old, because of good conduct, good penmanship. And he was awarded a diploma. And that was like 1931. And fortunately, that was saved.
Yeah.
Among so many other photos, of course, things like that. So all of us are historians. All of us are should take these possessions that we have very serious.
And it doesn't have to be, you know, the grand thing. It can be those everyday moments create a history. They tell our story. And you never know what it is that you're going to find in those documents. And, you know, with something like a good conduct or good penmanship document from school, that also tells the story of that school, that institution. You know, at that time, you know, institutions and places of learning that are no longer here. And so we have a documentation of those stories, of that narrative as well. And so thinking about not only how within the individual or within the family, the stories that can be told or, you know, to which they can contribute, but, you know, that broader, larger narrative, that bigger historic context.
Absolutely. This has been wonderful. So I have one last question, and I'm going to try not to make it so big because I think this one has potential going many ways. But this is especially for our community-based learning folks. And it is around how can local universities, so University of Texas, Houston Tillotson, St. Edward's, all of the different universities, ACC and colleges, use service learning to support like these grassroots preservation efforts?
I guess they need to be made aware of it, for one thing.
I do think also that I am who I am. The archive can't be left out of the equation, as has been said already in this conversation. History didn't start today when we opened our eyes, right? So even when work is focused on a particular time period, on a particular issue, on a particular community, taking the opportunity to engage with what's left from that time at our local repositories and libraries. There are such rich collections here in Austin. Such important work has been done already by colleagues of mine, present and past, to recover that work thoughtfully and carefully. And so I would just always encourage people to really place themselves in that history by engaging what we know already as we continue the work. The grassroots work for preservation is what really makes a difference. So do it first of all, but then also engage with the archive.
Absolutely. And I mean, just, you know, coming from the university perspective, having my students actually literally this morning in my African-American experiences in architecture class, it was our final day and I had students doing presentations on the research that they conducted over the semester, much of the required component of doing primary source research in archives done. And just learning from them based on the work that we've done, from conducting oral histories, for example. I had a group working on the Alexander family farm and speaking with descendants of that family, doing research on properties that were listed in the Green Book in Houston, for example, learning more about builders in Austin, primarily in the late 19th century, but moving into the 20th century, but also being forward thinking of not just doing the research and being one and done with it. How can we use that research and that activity as a form of social justice? Is it a website that will help the Alexander family continue to maintain their property and fight against continued attempts at eminent domain for that property? Creating a database of sorts, something not unlike with Dr. Roberts, who is an alumnus of the School of Architecture, which he's done with the Freedom Colonies Project, but creating, repositories for this kind of research, whether we're talking about Black builders in specific. And I think right now is a really good time for historians, for academics to work with the students and pursue these kinds of activities because the students are thirsty. But if we don't provide them with those opportunities to do this kind of research and to be very open about it, be very transparent about that research, then it's not going to be done. And I think, it's a missed opportunity. So just to take advantage of those opportunities and not just at the higher learning level, but what kind of programming, although, of course, there are powers that be in various entities that would be opposed to this kind of thing. But, from in the K-12 level, what kinds of programming, teaching, field trips, aside from the norms, can we offer students that then, stay within their mind, stay in their experience, and that will contribute to the kind of work that they might do in their community. Starting to ask family members about family history. Well, what's this building that used to be here? Or I learned this in school, or I heard this kind of thing, and being able to carry that with them through their experiences through school and beyond is really important as well. And so for my part, and really looking for and seeking these kinds of community relationships and to know really what is it, what kind of projects of research that is needed in the community, what kind of, public programming things that students can create that will assist communities in preserving their structures, telling their stories, and so on and so forth. Take advantage of that, definitely. But also, I think it's important for all of us to figure out then how to use these things and how to put them together, because there are lots of different institutions, organizations, and whatnot who are doing the memory work. But how can we collectively make that available and accessible? Accessibility, I think, is the key. Not only for the community, but for society at large to learn about the culture. And I think that, a site like the Chase Building and the programming of the Center for Community Engagement will be really crucial, really important for really helping to foster these kinds of relationships.
Anybody else want to add anything?
I was going to yield my time because, again, that was perfect. I will thank you. Oh, I'm like, I have nothing. But I will say this. We talked a lot about the summer team. In these situations where we're convening opportunity to learn in educational settings, whatever that might be, and talk about the halls and college on, there's a missed opportunity, I think, about when you are in the space of learning about our history, in the space about learning about what we need to preserve, to talk about that there are some transferable skills that go with that when you get in that space, right? So we don't always talk about what that does for critical thinking or how storytelling, in my opinion, is a hard skill. It's not a soft skill, right? You can transfer that into a variety of ways, whether it's a job. And sometimes I think we miss an opportunity in educational setting to talk about this transferable skill piece. Like how we present it is one thing, but how we leverage what you can parlay in that experience, I think, is a missed opportunity. So I always encourage people to think about what you're going to tell them, to think about what they get out of you telling them, and to think about what skills then to be extracted in any set by way of learning your history. So that's all I add. Otherwise, I really, you know, they have everything.
Yes.
I always love it.
No, thank you all so much for that, for this whole conversation. I'm really grateful. I'm full, and I'm sure that's going to be the same for many other folks. This work can be difficult and challenging, as you all know. And so this is having folks kind of encourage you and is really important. So thank you all so much. And I did want to mention that there are several projects that we're all in collaboration with in one way or the other that will begin to roll out. And please support and follow each of our guests' amazing work that they're doing. And Jeremy, I will bring you back.
So first, let me offer my thanks to our panelists. Appreciate y'all. Good snaps, claps, thank yous for y'all.
Yeah, I see.
And then also to our moderator, Stephanie, thank you for kind of leading us and guiding us in the discussion today. Big thanks to you as well. And then behind the scenes, again, Jason, thank you for holding it down, keeping it going, bringing people on and off stage. We really appreciate your support in that. This conversation was really great, y'all, and I thank you for allowing me to be privy to the conversation. Oftentimes, we don't get to hear about these histories. Sometimes we regulate them to the past as if they don't live with us today. In our architecture, in our horror histories, and the stories that we tell. But I hope from this, we see that these lived experiences are always in process. We're always in the process of becoming and getting to know and learning about that which came before us and that which is shaping our current moment. So thank you all for that. And with that, we have more conversations to come in the future. So thank you all for joining us today.
All right.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Anytime.
Thanks for joining us in this important conversation about community engagement and the historic preservation of Black history in Austin. Our next episodes will focus on intersectionality in community-engaged teaching, learning, and research, leading up to our community-based learning symposium this fall. Until then, keep up with the Center for Community Engagement on social media at UT_CCE on Twitter and Instagram, at UTexasCCE on Facebook, or visit our website, diversity.utexas.edu/community-engagement.